Welcome to What's Left, the weekly political discussion challenging the mainstream left. I'm Eduardo Barca with co-hosts, teacher and socialist Andy Lipson, and community organizer and fellow socialist Kenny Cepeda. We are online at what-s-left.webnode.com. We will be joined today by Alison McDowell to talk about the future of education and distance learning. Alison McDowell is a mom of a former Philadelphia public school student and a member of the Poor People's Army run by the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, who blogs about the intersection of race, finance, and technology at wrenchingthegears.com. We will link that link in our episode notes. We welcome you, Alison.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you. Why don't we start with Andy? If we can just hear from you, Andy, just share with us the connection that was made between you and Alison, because I think given the amount of discussions we've had about online distance learning, the future of education, how it's changing, and especially we're now beginning to see some of those changes because of the pandemic, if you could just share with us how this awesome connection that you made with Alison was made. Just coincidentally, it seems like it's fitting for everything we've been discussing in the most recent episodes.
Yeah. It turns out there's really not a coincidence to it. It's really just Alison has been looking at a world for many years that I've only started looking at in really any seriousness in the last 3 months. And that is the world of how technology and education are coming together. And I first heard about it when we heard about distance learning. I have been nervous about this before. There's next generation science standards that are increasingly asking us to synchronize all our educational programs so that all science teachers teach all the same things to all the students. I got the sense that they were trying to create a perfect science module using us, and I just felt like we were being done like auto workers in the old days where they try to figure out what can the auto worker do that's making the product that a machine can do later. And I just sensed that was going on, and I was really nervous about that, but I didn't know how to speak to that nervousness. It sounded like capitalism, but it also sounded like a crazy science fiction movie. And the more when this distance learning hit, I could now see that kind of weird sense that automation and taking our jobs and dismantling education, it just became much more real. And I needed to find people who were looking at this, and I found some teachers, and many of those teachers were directing to this woman, Alison McDowell. And really, when I looked at that video of yours, Future Ready Schools, which you will even say is dated now, it really scared the bejeebies out of me, you know. And I just knew I had to get you on our show and interview you, and I hope we can continue to collaborate, because the stuff you know, I believe, is going to be essential for anyone who's going to not just deal with education, but deal with the society that's being structured around it.
Humanity.
Yeah. You know, when Andy shared with me the link to your presentation, which we'll link in the episode notes for our viewers and listeners, I was taken back to Universal Studios, where there's this Terminator ride, amusements ride, where they were talking about the future and in different areas, and medicine and education. Anyhow, the point is that I remember being as a kid watching this amusement ride and thinking, my God, that's scary, and how there's going to be so many students being sitting in their homes or in a virtual classroom. And now I'm 31 years old, and it seems this is actually becoming slowly a realization during my lifetime, which I didn't think. So it's just very frightening stuff. Terminator stuff, sci-fi stuff. So I just thought your presentation really brought me to this reality that it's happening. There's a lot going on. So why don't we start with your background and what we're going to be discussing today, which is the role of technology in education. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about the future of education as you know it, and what you've been investigating.
Okay, so I live in Philadelphia, and my child, who is finishing, they just finished their first year in college. So we went through 13 years, kindergarten through 12, in the Philadelphia public school system. In our public schools, as I'm sure you guys can empathize, like we have been the target of privatization pretty much that entire time. And my learning curve was sort of, you know, in motion throughout that time. And so when I first like got involved in schools, it was more like, can you help with the auction or can you volunteer in the classroom? And so I did that through elementary school. And then in 2013, the city of Philadelphia hired Boston Consulting Group. And so the school reform commission, which wasn't under local control at that point, like we didn't have local control of our schools for like 15 years. And so they closed 23 schools in the spring and laid off 3,000 teachers. And I was so angry about that. And then later that summer, they actually had a group to talk about, a meeting to talk about school report cards and grading schools. And this we had heard about this in Indiana and other places. And it was like, you've closed all the schools, everybody is in upheaval, and now you're going to grade these schools. Like, this makes no sense. And you're having the meeting in late August when parents can't show up. And so, like, I organized a bunch of people to show up to this meeting, and we were very rambunctious. And then they canceled all the other meetings and said they were going to have a focus group. So I'm like, that's wrong. You know, and at that point, I still thought, oh, like they just don't know what they're doing is wrong. Like if someone went in and told them why it was wrong, like it would get better. And that was really naive. Like at this point, I'm like, you know, it is all broken on purpose. And it turns out the people who were funding that meeting about school report cards and universal enrollment, so that you would have one enrollment for all the magnet programs and charter schools and even private schools, was funded by the Dell Foundation, which at the time, my thought was like, oh, the Dell Foundation, you're interested in selling, you know, computers and software. And this is about like getting the market on our schools to sell your Dell products. And it wasn't until later that I realized that Dell actually like is one of their main contracts is with the NSA. So it really isn't just simply about selling the hardware and the software, but it actually also is very much embedded in sort of a larger state surveillance program. The situation with Dell was beyond just selling the hardware and the software. It was about collecting data and really monitoring overall, like the education delivery process. But I got involved and I'm like, we're going to withhold our test scores because you're using our test scores in this abusive way, not to help the schools, but to actually disrupt and cause harm. And so I did that for a few years and I worked with a national group called United Opt Out. It was a lot of parents across the country who were organizing these opt out movements. You know, and it worked to a point, but then eventually I was in a meeting where I was asking, because we have a legal opt-out in Pennsylvania for religious reasons, and it's in the state handbook. And I'm like, listen, I testified at the school board meeting, and I said, you need to make sure that letter goes out to all the families, and you need to have it translated in all the languages, and you need to make the copies for the schools because they can't make the copies. And at that point, they were like, okay. Which kind of took me aback because these would be people who, even if you were legally required to do it, would fight you every tooth and nail every time. And I'm like, what is going on? Like, why would they want to support the opt-out movement at this point? It made no sense. And so this was in the spring. And then over the summer was the lead up to ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act. And then what I began to realize is that in the adoption of that, it was all about growth and benchmark testing and the value-added model, and that end-of-year testing was going to have to go away anyway because really it was insufficient data. If you understand the markets are driven by data, having one end-of-year test is insufficient. And once you introduce technology, you can data mine kids all the time. And essentially what they would say is like, oh, you know, the end-of-year tests are so stressful. Wouldn't it be better if you just embed the tests and no one knows when you're being tested? You're just tested all the time. It's just all data aggregation. And so everything that we had done within the opt-out movement was co-opted and leveraged to advance this new program. And we didn't know, like, I mean, this was sort of my first revelatory thing, like, oh my gosh, like everything I did when we would say like, education isn't just about reading a math scores. And we'd be like, this is great. Actually, we should measure everything. Let's measure PE. Let's measure art. Let's put rubrics on everything. Actually, let's also measure emotional information and behavioral information. We should just put everything on a metric. And so everything that we said leading up to it was feeding this new phase of technological like connection into the classroom. And so at that point, my focus shifted to tracking the ed tech and specifically looking at what was happening with blended learning and the benchmark testing. And we had these things called SLOWs, student learning objectives, which feed into this growth model, like where the teachers would be asked to have the students do something before they even learned it so that they could prove that they learned something later. And it's a really twisted thing because then the kids are all stressed because they didn't learn the thing. Like, and even like within like gym, they would have the kids try to run 5 miles even though they hadn't trained for it. And then so then when they trained for it, they did better. You know, it's an abusive situation just to manage this data, to get these data points for like, you know, accountability purposes, but ultimately it will be for these market systems. So that's kind of my trajectory. And then eventually it became, for me, not just about the schools and the technology, but understanding that it was about managing people as data in this very disciplined, confining, surveilled world. And that it wasn't going to just be education. It was going to be through their health delivery, through mental health delivery, through their housing. That essentially my fear at this point, from what I've seen recently, is this idea that they would want to model society on KIPP. You know, like a KIPP model, you earn everything, your body is disciplined, you know, do the right hand motions, you're tracked all the time, and you have very limited social engagement. And I think that ultimately a lot of the individuals that are part of these other systems have ties to KIPP. And so I think they went to KIPP the world, which is really terrifying. It's a no excuse charter school.
Yeah. Could you say, first of all, could you say more about, let's start with KIPP. Just, people might not know what that model means. Can you spell that out more about what you mean when you say, that's a private charter school system.
It's a charter school.
It's a charter school model. It was developed through two alumni from the University of Pennsylvania, so it has ties back to Philadelphia. It's very much about sort of discipline. I believe it's knowledge is power. I don't know the other key program, but it's sort of very restrictive. Like kids have to earn their desk. You know, you have through your proper behavior. You're not supposed to talk in the halls. It's very limiting and monitored. And it's a franchise, you know, it's a very abusive. My colleague Jim Horn has written a book called Miss Measures of Education that talks about it, but it very much is about control and measurement and metrics. And I believe that there are a lot in California. I'm not sure in the area where you are, but they're actually, I think, structured as a benefit corporation, which is this new sort of company that's supposed to provide public benefit systems. And I think it was modeled actually on a teacher in Houston, like who was actually a lovely human being.
Right.
And the people who founded KIPP like connected with her and somehow stole her idea and turned it into this monstrous program. Mm-hmm.
Well, what about, can you say more?
Also it has ties to Angela Duckworth and Martin Seligman and grit and resilience and sort of the learned helplessness. So those are all also people at the University of Pennsylvania. So the character development, I forgot that. Grit is a key part of that. And there's a lot of mental manipulation that goes along.
Right.
So sorry.
And can you say more why, like, sometimes people hear collecting data and they go, well, that's not good, but why is that so bad? You know, can you maybe spell out more why we need to be concerned about the interests that are collecting data on us? And that's going to really become something that's going to be escalated as a result of this pandemic, it appears.
Right.
But can you say something more to help people understand why that's something that we need to resist and push back against?
Right. So when the Every Student Succeeds Act passed, there was a piece embedded in it that allowed for pay for success finance. And this idea of pay for success finance essentially was, it's like an outcomes-based government contract. That is performance measures, so that investors in a different, like a certain interventions, which are generally digital, if you can deliver data at agreed upon metrics, the investor gets paid back with some profit. And so that is very much a part of pay for success. And in 2014, I think the Obama White House actually asked, they had an RFQ for information from companies on high impact learning technologies. Because in order to run these investment deals, they need to be able to scale them and they need to collect the data in a very seamless and interoperable fashion. Because if you can't scale it, it's not profitable. I mean, if you can't get it into, you know, thousands of schools, it won't make the money that they want to make on these deals. And so if you look at this RFQ, and I have it in my little sis is where I do a lot of my storing, like my research and documents, there are like 200 pages of submissions about these high impact learning technologies. And so essentially what we're looking at is using a digital interface to engineer performance, right? But it's in sometimes it's an academic performance, but increasingly it's also going to be non-cognitive skills and social emotional learning, which is one of the things that came out of, you know, the evolution of the opt-out movement was we were like, well, we care about all the whole child. And they're like, well, great. We like social emotional learning. Let's make some metrics for that. And so all of these things, you know, having like it's engineering people as data for these dashboards, for these investment programs. And so what happens is that the success that they offer is very narrow. I mean, it's like to say that education is represented by a third grade test score, especially these reading guarantees are tied in with this pay for success. The third grade reading scores are part of the Chicago school district. They have a pay for success program that looks at kindergarten, special education, and then third grade test scores. So a lot of you're hearing in different states about these third grade reading guarantees that the kids, if they don't score a certain level, can't move on to fourth grade. That has everything to do with these finance models. And people are just simply not aware. And so increasingly, like they'll pick a success metric and then everything else falls by the wayside. And as you have these online modules, kids are getting feedback loops and essentially they become engineered on a dashboard as data. They're not, you lose the relationality, you lose, you know, it's mentally very harmful for kids to spend, like to be stuck in these screen-based systems. And it's for Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan Chase is what it's for. And so people really need to become familiar with how that's going to work and that it is embedded in the federal legislation.
I wanted to ask you if you think that some of these programs are targeting low-income families specifically.
Very much. I mean, so...
Because I know KIPP. For example, if I just because you said KIPP in right. Here in San Francisco has targeted some of the most impoverished families, and I informally fostered / mentored a kid that went to a KIPP academy here in San Francisco, and they were mostly trying to find outreach families that were low income and maybe
very much. So and for them the technology feels I mean and that's what's so insidious about it is that. Because Philadelphia is a very low-income district. And so it's framed as equity, right? And closing the
right.
digital divide. And, you know, you need to get the hands. You need everyone connected on broadband.
Right.
And when schools that have been systematically underfunded and defunded and austerity and they can't even get paper, when someone shows up with carts of Chromebooks, they feel like, wow, someone's paying attention. Like, we're getting stuff. Like, they're listening. We need resources. We're getting resources. Look at these Chromebooks. And what people are not, the piece that isn't said is that essentially these are data collection devices. Like if you look back at the history of surveillance of this country, it's COINTELPRO. Like your Chromebook is your COINTELPRO device. And once, like for us, we're the home of Comcast in Philadelphia. Well, they negotiated a deal to have, you know, low-cost internet access is called Internet Essentials or something, which is great. I'm not really interested in having people, low-income people, ripped off for their internet, but in this new model that we're going to talk about where schools don't exist anymore, you have to have broadband in every single house because kids can't really do school on a phone. So they have to have their Chromebook and they have to be able to do it at home. So they're working with the housing authorities and low-income people. And so even if they're paying $200 a year for their low-cost internet, Comcast is making out like gangbusters because they've already got the infrastructure in place. So now they've boosted. So now parents, low-income parents are paying, you know, several hundred dollars a year just to access their free public education. And the thing about a Chromebook is that, like, this is not an Apple laptop where you can actually create lots of stuff. It's a consumption device. It's set up that you can either access Google, right, like the Google Classroom. And so all of this is feeding into Google. Or you can, like, consume online content. But you can't make much stuff on a Chromebook. And most of the kids think they're pretty crappy. And to log in, like our school district has Google accounts for the school district accounts. they say that there's Philadelphia School District, but through Google. And we refuse that. I'm probably one of the only families in the district that we refuse to use the school district Google because they can data mine that. And, you know, and they can watch the teachers and they can, so, you know, there are many elements of digital access. While I will say it's true that this is the world we live in, that people need access. I'm not disregarding that, but it's a double-edged sword. And I would say the other thing that people need to remember is back in 2010, so a decade ago, Lower Merion School District, which is just outside of Philadelphia, it's the richest school district in the state of Pennsylvania, it's on the main line. Their students got laptops. They were the first, like one of the first one-to-one laptop districts. Their district was spying on their kids through the laptops. And these were nice Apple laptops. And they were spying on the kids. And like the FBI got involved. And then eventually the FBI threw the kids under the bus. Now the families won, like, were able to win in civil court. But no one supported the kids in Lower Merion against being surveilled on their fancy Apple laptops, let alone what's going on with Chromebooks in low-income families. So, you know, I'm open to having a more robust conversation about equity and closing the digital divide, but my gut feeling is that it could very well be the digital jail and we won't know it until the doors are shut.
Right?
Like, oh, we should have done something differently, but we didn't. And knowing the history of this country and knowing the ways in which power structures are meant to contain any potential sort of revolutionary process or people thinking differently about things, like, that's not happening on a Chromebook. Or not for long.
No.
It's like this suspicious activity that Facebook is trying to bring broadband internet to some of the poorest countries in Africa right now. I was just listening to on the BBC. What are the intentions behind that? What are you asking in return? You see, it's just, anyhow, it's tied to
it's
this.
It's biocapitalism. Right. They need to extract data out of people's bodies and our social relationships. So,
anyhow.
Kenny, did you want a question in here?
Yeah, I'm curious a little bit about, you know, backtracking to your journey into, you know, where you're at right now.
Right.
I'm curious as to what kind of parents, you know, you maybe organize with. You know, I just think of, you know, San Francisco. I'm involved right now in delivering food to low-income people that have been affected by COVID. And often we engage in conversations about education. And so it always comes back to work, in the sense that some parents now face the choice of going to work, you know, low-income parents,
right,
and staying at home trying to figure out technology for their kids. So I just see that there is a connection, right? In order to fight back, to be able to be involved in your kids' education, I suspect that you do have to have the economic, some sort of economic freedom to be able to challenge and have the time to investigate these things. So yeah. I'm just curious as to what kind of parents you organize with, who, you know, which parents were more involved, and if there's, you know, sort of a type.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I would have to. I mean, my good friend Tanya Ba, she ended up like later running for city council, and she was a powerhouse. She's African American. She has two. Her kids were my kids' age. She has a special needs child with pretty serious needs, and Shakita Gaines, and she was head of Home and School for a long time. Also African American. For the most part, like, we were pretty small. There was a group of teachers who were pushing back at a school called Feltonville, which was in like a Spanish-speaking community, a high immigration community, and they, you know, because the standardized testing like clearly affected English as a second language students in particular. And so we had a small number of teachers, some of whom were also parents, involved in the opt-out piece. I mean, unfortunately, the technology part, we never really could get off the ground. And I have to say, like, you know, I hate to say I was right, you know, but I kept trying to tell the teachers, like, we need to get on this. We need to get on this. And I think because people, for the most part, are in immediate crisis, right? Like, people are getting through the day. People are managing their kids. People, like, I am in a position of, I work half time and I do this the other half of my time. And I'm not doing it because I get paid, or I'm like on the ego trip. But like, it scares the crap out of me because I understand the trajectory of this. Like, we need collective liberation because this thing is coming after everyone. Like, yeah. And so, I think it's difficult because we don't have, I don't have the answer of what to do next, right? Yeah. And so it's very hard for people who are already really stressed out to say, can I tell you a whole bunch of more terrible things I don't have an answer to? Because that also is not great, right? And I understand that. And so organizing more through the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. Sherry Honkala has been working in sort of welfare rights for 20, 30 years, housing rights. She works with the Kensington welfare rights and has done that for decades. And she was a parent, like we connected, but she is poor. She's white, but she lives in Kensington, which is the center of the heroin epidemic. So that is a group that is led by the poor, and I try to support, like, as an intelligence person, like, to give them information. But they're in the trenches, like, handing out food, right, and getting people housing. And so I'm trying to sort of figure out at this point, a lot of what I do is try to tell white people not to do this. Like people have privilege to say, this is what you're actually doing. And I try to show up in the places and disrupt and say, what you're doing is not right. Like, it's based in this long history of racial capitalism, and to call them out, because I can't tell people what to do. Like, in impacted communities, it wouldn't be right, like, for me to say that, you know, I know the answer and this is what you should do. I can try to share to the extent that people want to know. And I can try to go to the power systems and confront. You know, so I've worked with people from a wide range. But it's hard. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, mostly I do stuff by myself. Mm-hmm. Because it's hard to know this. And it's not like, even within union things or other, like, socialist groups, like, it's not a campaign, right? It's not like rent control. It's not one thing. And like, we have a pretty vibrant, like, left anarchist kind of thing in Philly, but like, they don't get me. I'm like, okay. Like, yeah. They don't get me either. So I'm like, all right, I try. Like, maybe eventually, like, we'll hit up and you'll figure out, like, what I'm talking about. I'm like, it's a new form of capitalism. It's biocapitalism. Like, it's the next virtual reality seller colonial frontier on 5G. But they don't know it yet. So,
well, one of the things I think, and you kind of said when you said it's a double-edged sword, and I think the capitalists kind of get away with getting people to think that we can turn one end of that sword in our favor. And that's the mistake I feel like I've fallen into, believing that the data or the internet it is an opportunity. It's a basis for potentially organizing. But at the end of the day, this technology is controlled by the capitalists. And so it's not, unless we take on the people who rule us, then these technologies will be used against us. And that's the part that I think is when people go, well, maybe somehow this data could be, maybe we can bend it to our will and make it work our way within this system. And that's where I feel like people fall for it. And it keeps catching up to us. Like, people first thought the internet was this liberatory thing. And now we are seeing that this thing is actually, as long as we keep the system in place, this kind of control system in place, it's going to be used as a mechanism of social control, unless we take it out of their hands and either build a new system for ourselves. You know, so I think that's one of the reasons why sometimes people, like, this thing runs so deep into the ground that people just kind of wonder and hope that it can be used another way within the system.
I just wanted to mention that I came across this article from The Economist that basically was declaring data, you know, the new oil, basically, or, yeah. You know, data is more profitable or more valuable than oil nowadays. And I don't know if you have anything to say about that, Alison.
Well, I mean, I think we're sort of reaching, like, peak oil. And, I mean, right now, like, the Saudis are moving their money into robotics and AI. Right. So, you know, it's very interesting because as I've done the research, there's a lot of oil interests in ed tech, and there's a lot there's hotbeds happening in Dallas and Tulsa, right, in the oil centers. You know, and there's part of me that feels like, oh, maybe the oil companies are moving their portfolios because they see that, you know, how things are going, our alternative energies. But I think that really, like, I'm in Pennsylvania. We're a huge center for fracking, right? Like, we're a fracking place. The fracking trains run through the garden where I work. I think these technologies are looking to frack us, like, for this data and for this profit. And this is being set up in these pay-for-success deals that are going to be tied into the education training centers, into the health delivery, and that's why everything is being platformed. And Eric Schmidt is, I mean, we saw what's happening in New York State with Cuomo now, and that they're, you know, he's working on healthcare, Gates is working on the education piece. When I first did my talk in 2016, like, the four most highly capitalized companies were all cloud computing based entities. You know, it was Apple, it was Google Alphabet, it was Amazon, and Facebook. And they're all involved in education because that is where the profit center is. And the more data that you have, the more potential profit, because they want interoperable data. And so that's what's so upsetting about, like, Google Classroom, is that Google is ahead on artificial intelligence development because they run their training algorithms against the data that they have. And pretty much Google will always win because we gave them all of our data. Yeah. To run their training algorithms on. I mean, the other thing that a lot of people don't know is, like, out in Bluffdale, in Utah, there's the NSA has built a giant data center to hold 100 years worth of data on every person, like a century's worth of data on everybody. And that's really chilling, because there's this idea that, you know, in a culture that is increasingly totalitarian, you know, and limited in terms of free thought and what you can say and what you can think, this idea that suddenly laws can be passed that activity that you engaged in up until recently becomes illegal, and then you do something like, well, but that person did all these things that are now illegal, so we should look at them. Or, like, if you cross the wrong line, then they just tap into your entire, like, a FISA court, and they just tap into your whole record, and it's all there. So, I mean, the thing about Google and Eric Schmidt, who I think the quote is attributed to, the data is the new oil, they're very much funding New America, which is a think tank that is advancing a lot of this. And they're also, Eric Schmidt is funding the Center for the Future of War at Arizona State University. And so that what is, like, automated weapons and drones and weaponized narrative, right? And so this is, like, when you understand education delivery, just thinking about, really, this is what they're after, is total quality management. They've been after it since the 80s. It literally, like, Xerox was consulting with the Mark Tucker's group, saying, like, you can do total quality. We can engineer your human capital to corporate U.S. Chamber of Commerce needs, and we will design your people. And eventually, if you get to AI, you can run, you can train someone's mind to be exactly what you need them to be. But the world that they're building through the fourth industrial revolution, like, humanity is pretty disposable. So they might build you to be something and then just throw you away. And then maybe break you down and try to rebuild you as something else. But, like, we're already in a world with so much mental trauma and mental health. Like, to essentially start submitting people to AI processing through online education systems in the totalitarian context is really problematic. So, I don't know. Does that answer?
You know, Naomi Klein talks about the shock doctrine, Alison, mm-hmm. and talks about how there are ideas that are lying about.
Yeah.
That take some shock, some catastrophe, some pandemic, war, natural disaster, mm-hmm. for suddenly some of these corporate class to push their agenda forward for some of the things that may have seemed impossible before.
Yeah.
And now, during this pandemic, we are seeing some of those things being pushed forward, as you had mentioned with Cuomo and Bill Gates. I saw the presentation with Bill Gates as well.
Right.
And what are you starting to see, are you, do you have the, your finger, what is that expression when you have your
finger to the wind.
Are you starting to see that strong current of wind coming through with
it's the speeding up?
Yeah. I feel like you are really this, you're more aware than most. And is it now the time that acceleration 4D technologies are happening?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of what I do is I just read a lot of what industry says it wants to do. And I think I'm different in that, like, academics, like higher education, like their worthiness is like theory and writing for each other, right? Like they read each other and write each other and refer to each other, but they don't, like, they would never bother to read a LinkedIn profile or a white paper or like know who went to what conference. Like that's just not how they operate.
Right.
And then you have like the people who are in the trenches and the teachers who are busy and trying to keep up and the families who are struggling and trying to keep up. And so they're not in a position of reading any of the stuff. And so I live in this crazy world where I've like read all of the stuff the industry says, and it's almost like it's a fait accompli. Like it's done. The horse is out of the barn. It's gone. And then everybody else has no clue. So it's very hard to balance, like, on the one hand, feeling like it's over, and on the other hand, like nobody knows it's over. So KnowledgeWorks is one of the key big like entities in this transition. And I would recommend anybody go to the KnowledgeWorks website. They have dozens of white papers saying exactly what their plan is. And, you know, I would read these plans saying that we're planning on there being no physical schools. You would have a drop-in center. You would go out, you would collect badges and stackable credentials, and you do this wearable technology that tracks you and uploads your skills to the cloud. And I'm thinking, how are they going to do that? You know, I would tell my husband, I'm like, this is what they're saying they're going to do. And it's like, that will never happen. And I'm like, I don't know. They think it's going to happen. It's like, that would never happen. And so, like, I'm like, how are they going to close all the schools? Because they're like, no one would put up with that. I'm like, but here they have. They've done it. I mean, it's a soft coup. I mean, it has happened. And if people can't dial back and don't plug into understanding the reality of the situation, like, we're in really bad shape. I mean, at this point, I'm like, how do we create subaltern, like, knowledge-sharing resistance centers to keep it going? Like, and who are going to be the teachers? Because, I mean, what's happened is all of the higher education systems have been bought in. So the teachers who are trained now, and many of whom are just doing alt certification stuff, like, you know, they're not even doing a full education degree, they're brought up in data-driven education dashboards, tech. They don't know any different. And I remember even when I was working on the opt-out, we had some reading groups, and there was a young teacher, and like the teachers in their early to mid-20s had never been in school without standardized curriculum. And I mean, I'm 51. So like I read books, like, and even my child who finished up, like, really up until like fifth grade, and then they ended up being in a magnet school, so they were special, right? And I kept trying to like leverage the reputation of this school to fight back, and none of those people wanted to fight back on behalf of the other kids. But like, we got books and paper and wrote things and wrote poetry and did art and did things. And, you know, my background, I'm an art history major. And like, and I have a master's in cultural landscapes. I mean, I studied all the wrong stuff, I will admit it. Like, I mean, at this point, I'm like, oh, I really studied all the wrong stuff. But I got the tools to figure it out later. Like, there's going to be no art history people. Are you kidding me? Do you think, like, the Walton people and Gates and Bloomberg want art history and they don't? Because you might think about something differently. Like, you might actually put dots together something that the AI doesn't tell you.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I maybe
well,
got off. But the KnowledgeWorks. Like, I did not know how they were going to close all the schools. And clearly they have. I mean, the other piece from my presentations I've talked about, you know, I think for a while people thought, well, maybe I can move to another school district. Or maybe I can move to another state.
Right.
Or maybe I can go to Finland. Right? Like, people kept leveraging, like, maybe I can go here. But what we need to understand is that this is all running through the OECD and the PISA test. And it's tied to the paper success stuff isn't just the U.S. federal government. It's the World Bank. So like there's, we have to fight where you stand because there's no getting away from this thing that's coming.
Right.
It's tied in with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, of which education is goal number 4. And essentially what they have said is that what they want is ICT technology, like individual communication technology, which for most of, you know, the global South is phones and tablets. They're not even going to get a Chromebook. They're just going to get a small device to like learn how to read on a phone because that's the data capture piece. It's big.
Well, and it also, I mean, this is going to be, since data is going to be now the new weapon that states and corporations have to collect to compete with each other, and ultimately states, mm-hmm. that definitely is the Whitney Webb article that talks about how China, right. how China's yeah. surveillance and data collection is essentially like the U.S. ruling class is licking their chops, trying to figure out how do we do that and keep up with that, and that's going to mean Europe has to do the same thing. So if you feel like, if you don't want to be a colony, that you are data mined, if you want to be a data miner, then you have to get ahead of this. Because the other thing about the new imperialism, but the other aspect of imperialism you're describing about is colonies are now the places where more data is. How do you collect that data and who gets it now? And which state gets it? And which state can claim the data in order to feed an AI, which is ultimately going to be used for economic competition, but also military competition, which the U.S. has definitely expressed the desire to say, if we are going to stay ahead of everyone else, we have to develop our AI better than anyone else, which means we have to collect data on more of our citizens and get better at it than any other ruling class in the world.
I mean, and the thing about this learning ecosystem model is embedded in smart cities. So Philadelphia is a smart city. One of the other entities that's very active in this is the MacArthur Foundation based in Chicago, the Genius Award people. So they actually put like tens of millions, maybe $100 million into pushing digital media and learning. And they actually hired an organization called Frameworks to set it all up to really get, they worked with Mozilla to get these skills badges set up. And they had a program that spun off to something called Collective Shift, which like came out of the MacArthur Foundation, called Cities of LRNG. So Philly is a city of LRNG, Chicago, Dallas. They're about 10, but they're all smart cities. So this idea that you're in your device pinging off against, you know, various things in the city and building up, it's almost like you're living in a video game, you know, and that you have to level up and demonstrate your compliance, not only to your cognitive tasks, but your social emotional tasks, your non-cognitive tasks as well. You know, and for me, like I wrote a piece a while ago, it was like a little touchy, but I called it navigating whiteness. And I was like, well, like we live in a city, we had the Starbucks incident where two black men were accosted by the police waiting in a Starbucks, right? And so now we say we're gonna have a learning ecosystem and like, you know, you're going to put a Chromebook or a tablet in the hands of all of these high school kids, you know, many young black men, and say, like, just go for it. Just wander around the city and collect your education. Like, meanwhile, we have, like, systems of policing and violence. I mean, some of which state mediated, some of which is, like, private. Like, but that's not safe.
Right.
Like, there are many ethical elements of, like, this sort of freedom to learn in the city where we're not actually talking about, like, what it is to be, you know, within a persecuted community operating in a militarized police smart environment and expected to collect your education credits. Like we're just haven't talked about that yet. And I think on the left and right, it's so freeing. Look, you get out of school and you get away from this terrible jail because they built schools as jails now. Yeah. I mean, essentially there's many aspects of trying to navigate in school systems that are in many ways like not pleasant at all. So this is being portrayed as a great option. But, you know, what does that look like with now we've got drones and maybe robot police dogs patrolling? Like, it's not good. Mm-hmm. So.
Kenny, yeah. You got a question?
No. It was a comment on, you know, backtracking a little bit on the accessing, you know, data mining from other countries and just tying it back to our population, you know, talk. Because these are future markets, you know, untapped markets that, you know, some of these capitalists are going to be fighting for. And so, you know, getting ahead and being able to sell stuff and, you know, I actually, again, I find it suspicious because I do hear, you know, in Guatemala, you know, foundations pushing technology in order to say that, you know, that's the future, that's, you know, that's the way to go in order to create equity. But in reality, what we get is, you know, by evidence of what's happening right now, an enhancement of the already existing inequities, you know, and it's really about exploitation. It's not about, you know, equity at all. That's just
about. But it's interesting because a lot of it comes through, like, there's a development aid component where these things are prototypes, like, in, you know, global south areas, and then they say, like, look, oh, it's the best. It's what all of the great people in the U.S. are doing, so you want it too. And then they'll refine things, and then they'll bring them back here. So, like, Ridge International Academies that Zuckerberg is backing, and I believe Gates is backing, was all over Africa. And, like, you know, they're privatizing their public education system so people have fee-based, and they say, oh, well, this is more affordable just to do it on a tablet than to actually have real school. And so it is fully global. And I think in Latin America, especially the Inter-American Development Bank is going to be pushing these pay for success deals. And like I was looking into stuff in the Caribbean, they're already in Jamaica. And I mean, the other thing about Latin America too is that these use channeling capital through people, right? Through educational technologies, through health interventions, through mental health interventions. It's a way of channeling these global capital flows. The entities that are connected to that, you know, it's these big pots of money. So it's the Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan's, but it's also the teachers' pension funds, it's TIA Craft too, right? And SEIU. And it's Kaiser Permanente's money. Like it's all seeded with foundation money. But there are big faith institutions that are sitting on giant pots of money that would love nothing better than to like run human capital bonds and say they're helping humanity. Right. And so the Vatican Bank is a huge player in the space and actually very closely tied to Tom Steyer, who is in the Bay Area, the former presidential candidate, and Pierre Omidyar, also in the Bay Area. So they're working with the Vatican to set this up. So like I fully believe like within throughout Latin America that that's a huge piece is the Vatican's. But also that Latter-day Saints, right? Huge, huge resources. And so my concern is advancing with these systems of surveillance and managing people as capital is that like we're reaching like a techno-fascist angle, but it could actually be a theological techno-fascism, which is kind of really even like takes it up a few more notches.
And really harder to say.
Yeah. Theological techno-fascism. Like, you could say it. Like really, like I feel like I'm running around telling faith communities, hey, don't put people on blockchain. Bad idea. Like, I mean, and for me, and I have to say, like, trying to navigate this, I know stuff that a lot of people don't want to know. I look fairly non-threatening to other white, you know what I mean? Like, I'm like, she's got gray hair. Like, she, you know, like, how bad can she be? Like, so I can go around and tell people who look like me, like, don't do these things. Like, this is what it will mean if the Unitarian Church decides to go into pay for success and tech bonds. You don't, you know, you might think it's a progressive, wonderful social justice program. It's not.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe as a way of actually, well, I'm transitioning because we've been talking, we haven't just been talking about education. We started with education.
Yeah.
But clearly the pretext for this transformation of education, the blended learning, it was really chilling for me to hear in your talk in 2016 when you were saying, well, they're going to move to this blended learning thing, and this is what they're talking about. Like, now they're talking about blended learning. Like, in August, we're going to blended learning and reimagining schools and stuff like that. But there's also, there have been talking about all these, what's it called, contact tracing, all these health element initiatives that are simultaneously taking place, of course, that are being justified on the basis of COVID and things like that. The same justifications that are being used to transform education, to collect our data. Can you talk about some of those changes that are being, and also the forces that are behind some of those things?
So one of the things I have been looking at, like beyond the technology that was linked to pay for success, is this idea, the community school model, really, and sort of really teasing out what was meant by that model. And I think a lot of people wanted to believe that the community school premise was something about really providing supports.
Wraparound supports.
Families in need, like wraparound services, right? And really, all of those wraparound services were going to be pay for success opportunities, right? And so, like, this idea that you would bring, because Obama gutted FERPA, like the rights protection, so they're very weak protections for data. If you bring social services into schools and start collecting data, it's much more flexible to access that data and use it for things than it would be if it was HIPAA in a clinical setting. So my concern with the contact tracing, especially knowing the high levels of poverty that are coming up, is that one, and kids are pretty traumatized, right? Like, this is really, like, this is traumatic. It's isolating, you know, families that don't have access to, that are food insecure, who don't have regular, you know, who are unhoused. It's going to be really bad. And so under this premise of, like, helping, if you start inserting presences through contact tracing or other things in these families, one, it's setting them up to be human capital in these finance deals. But two, once you start getting into people's situations, like, I have a great fear about, like, family separation and ways in which social welfare services are used to take children from families, not because they're unsafe, it's because they're poor. And foster care is also another impact investing scheme. And I also have a lot of concerns around contact tracing and undocumented students and their families, right? Like, is anyone in the teacher, like, who is talking about that at this point? I think, you know, the AFT is, you know, saying we need all this testing and tracing, but what does that actually look like? And where is the power in these systems? Do we believe that it actually is for the benefit of the broader good? Or is it about profiling people and this level of overreach? Because I know in Philadelphia, like, we have social services, but it's not like there's a huge amount of untapped largesse out there that if people just had a good caseworker that they could get. That's not true. Like, we have way more need than we have services. So I guess that's the piece, like, both the contact tracing and also I can foresee once it reopens that there will be a big, and I think maybe in the AFT document, they talked about community school model and providing these services, that if pay for success is layered in, it could very well put families at risk in ways that I think that our people are not fully anticipating.
Yeah, and just to be clear, like, other people might not know this, but the NEA, National Education Association, National Union for Teachers, and the AFT, American Federation of Teachers, are literally begging to be contact traced as a condition for reopening schools. And that to me was like, are you kidding me? Like, this is very, like, without almost thinking, what does this mean for people's privacy? And really the people who face the biggest hammer potentially will be the illegal immigrants. Because they, I mean, how do you get into that contract trace? And you better get into it, or, so it's very, like, it's a problem. It's a problem that our workers' unions are begging for this technology to be used, because it's going to be used against us.
Well, like I said, I think that a lot of the health services are being set up for pay for success. And I feel very confident that the pension funds and things will also be feeding into pay for success. And in fact, is Lily Eccleston Garcia still in charge of NEA, or did she step down?
I don't, that name doesn't ring a bell.
Okay. Well, she was up to this point, but her background was in ed tech. And specifically also she worked in the school district in Utah that was the later became home of the first social impact bond for pre-K. So, like, the union at the top, they have signed on for this reimagined school without school. And I don't think anybody bothered to tell, like, rank and file teachers, oh, by the way, they're going to replace you with avatars that get the data with fidelity. Like, they're not saying that to the teachers. And, you know, I know there are a lot of social justice caucuses out there, and I've tried to sort of push on both the community schools and the pay for success and the tech, and really gotten very, it hasn't hit yet. I don't know what to say about that. That's why essentially at one point I sort of pulled back from education as an area for my research and expanded it, because I'm like, if I can't make it in schools, they're doing this to, you know, people in addiction in my city. They're doing it for unhoused people in my city. Like, this is an apparatus that's coming after everyone. So I will just try to keep, follow the energy and try to find people who want to know and try to organize some alternative to what's happening.
Does anyone, I want to speak to how developmentally inappropriate tech is, especially because, if I may, does anyone else have a question for Alison? Alison, I will be sharing this widely with some of my former colleagues that I worked with at three different elementary schools. I remember just as an educator some years back that I was in a classroom where I saw a screen with this app called Dojo. And I think your presentation.
Yeah. It's going to be great for the blockchain gig economy.
So I heard it in your presentation when I was listening to the YouTube video where I heard this. And Alison, I remember sitting in the classroom and how this teacher was using it to give points to the different students with different badges and different sort of like avatar gaining points and getting this sort of avatar if they got a certain amount of points. And I just saw that the children, the way that they would react to this, it was very trying to please this system that was happening in the classroom. And I just felt there was a lack of creativity and the hindrance for fully self-expressed. And there was also this fear that would come from the students not being able to get this avatar, as well as one more thing I remember seeing, just this competition that was very pervasive because of this program. When you mentioned it in your presentation, I sort of looked and said, well, I guess I wasn't as crazy or as mad, you know, thinking that this was wrong for primary education. Can you please, I will be sharing this with my brother who has my five-year-old nephew. Just, I volunteered at this school, and just the technology that is slowly, you talked about a slow coup, that is entering like a Trojan horse into this, into the educational, into schools. The things that teachers are sort of not, I don't think they do it because there's malintent. I think that there is this, as you said, the soft coup where people are trying to use the systems that are being offered to them by tech companies such as Dojo.
Right.
And that is slowly trying to take over the way that we teach and the way that we are functioning in school systems. And there is, I don't want to say ignorance, what's another word, sort of this being convinced, I think educators are slowly being convinced that when I go up to my nephew's school teacher, I will say, you know, this iPad or this program, or I'm just hoping if we can opt out, they'll say, well, what is the harm in it? Can you talk and speak to just how developmentally inappropriate this is for especially small children and child growth and development?
I'm not an expert like on the development stuff. So I mean, as a parent, I can sort of speak to that. I mean,
fair enough. Yeah.
I mean, I remember the first time when my child was in third grade. Okay, so they're like a freshman in college. So this is a while back, of seeing a grading rubric for a project, and I never seen a rubric before. I guess today no one can imagine doing anything without a rubric. But I was like, what is that? Like, you used to just get grades and, you know, comments or whatever, like, and, you know, and even certainly, you know, my mind has opened more, a lot more about like the grade as a thing, but even like the rubric has like all the embedded micro grades in it. And I was sort of shocked by just the structure of it. And now, you know, all of these online systems are essentially like making more and more granular your performance. And so I will say a lot of this is a gamification, right? Like, you know, the Class Dojo gamifying things, making it like this sort of fun, interactive video game. And there's a professor here in Philadelphia at Wharton, which is the business school of Penn. And his name is Kevin Werbach. And he's just like the wunderkind of blockchain and gamification. Okay. So you also have to know gamification is used like by hedge funds and like modeling. But he gave a talk that like I quoted a couple times. And at the end, like in this Q&A, you know, he said, well, you know, sometimes people don't even know that they're in the game. And the thing is, you want to be the one that's making the rules. Like sometimes people don't even know the rules, but like the Wharton people, like this is the just heads up, like be the person who's coding the game. Right. And, you know, these days with these technological systems, you don't know who's coding the game. You don't know exactly what the rules are. Like there could be an upgrade and next week the rules are different or the points are weighted differently or the algorithms are different. And there's no accountability and there's really no way of going back into that. And your behavior is shaped through this. And, you know, like Summit Learning is one of these platforms and that's like backed by, you know, Facebook. And like we know that Facebook has said that they manipulate people's feeds to see if they can make people depressed, right? So when we're handing over education, like in interaction to these corporate entities that at one point may just like with the AI become some sort of decentralized, like generalized thing that no one has control over, we're losing our humanity and our autonomy. And I would say, like, I mean, I was always taught that limit screen time, you should limit screen time. And in 2016, the Democratic National Convention was in Philadelphia. And they had a number of different sessions the public could go to. And one was by Common Sense Media, which I think it's Tom Steyer's brother. Is it James Steyer? I think he's in the Bay Area. So they, Common Sense Media wants to be the gatekeeper of quality content. And I remember going into this event after work, and I was a little late because it was after work, and it was sort of like, you know, who is she? Like, it's like everyone knew each other, and they were all 25, and then I walked in. And I tried to sort of say, they were all about controlling technology use at home. Like, put the phone away and have dinner. And it was all of this stuff. And I'm like, but what about the technology in our schools? And they're like, totally blew me off about that. Like, they didn't care. They didn't care about tech in schools. They wanted to control how you were at in your home. And that really struck me. And that same week, there was another event held by Epic Games. And Epic Games is based in Raleigh-Durham. They create a lot of very popular, including Fortnite, which I heard for a while, like Fortnite had hijacked the minds of like
took over my classroom last year.
Exactly. So Epic Games like had a whole session called during the DNC, hosted by Atlantic Magazine and like a sports bar with like open bar and all sorts of swag. And I don't really even go to these things, but my friend Tamika was like, you should go. And I'm like, I went. And it was Suzanne DelBene, who's a representative, former Microsoft from Washington State. She's the head of the Internet of Things Caucus. It was a woman who's now a professor at UC Irvine, who is very big about game development, one of our progressive city council people, and then the head of Epic Games. And the whole time, and this was supposed to be on education in the creative economy or the creative of tomorrow, was about how to get kids to code his video games. It's like, we need all these kids to code our video games. And I'm like, and I think maybe even Randy Weinberg was in some back room somewhere at this event. I'm like, well, this isn't about education, like coding your video games. And everyone's like, yes, just code the video games. And then what I realized is like, this next couple of generations, their plan is to build a virtual reality world, that the world is a game. It may be augmented reality. Pokemon Go was sort of the first venture of that. But they are going to turn education, just like, you know, previous generations built the Transcontinental Railroad, the skyscrapers of New York, they built things. The thing that the next generation of kids coming up, they're supposed to build augmented reality. And it's going to be a game, and it's going to be run by people like Epic Games with Disney and the military and Kevin Werbach, who's like coding the games and nobody even knows they're in the game. And so that's what education is becoming through these digital platforms. And we're at risk of that. And I would say the other piece of this is about wearable tech, because right now there's a lot of focus on screen-based limit screen time. Soon it's not going to be screens. It will be wearable technology. And we've got the BrainCo headbands, smart uniforms, they're going to capture all of that. And there's a system called XAPI or Tin Can API that will capture wearable data and upload it to the cloud. And so a few years ago, I did research for people in North Dakota. The state of North Dakota was being taken over their whole entire education system for competency-based education, which all of the digital stuff is tied to competency-based education because that's going to be the badges. And Doug Burgum, who was the governor at the time, was former Microsoft. And so he was rolling this all out. And they're like, we're not going to have any grades anymore, like age-based grade cohorts. And all the kids, like, no one's going to be in high school after 10th grade. You're going to be in a work-based learning program. And I don't want to see you in the high school. You should be out learning things, even though we know that everyone else is saying we don't know what the jobs are going to be for the future. And I'm like, well, what are you going to do in North Dakota for project-based learning? Like, no offense, but I'm like, what does that look like? You know, what does the learning ecosystem look like in North Dakota? Because, you know, I'm feeling kind of superior because all the people who left Philadelphia to, like, for the suburbs for their kids. Well, I'm like, well, we got all the best stuff, right? We got the hospitals, we got the law firms, we got the art museums. Like, you know, what do you got way out there? Like the Chili's? Like, what is your learning? And I'm like, well, what does that look like for North Dakota? Like, what are they going to do? Well, they're going to put a VR headset on and they're going to do online gig work project-based hands-on learning with haptic controllers. And they're going to start running remote factories from North Dakota. Like through this new, and this is like in the next decade, like maybe this isn't 6 months from now, but that's why they don't care if they're in North Dakota, because once you put a virtual reality headset on, you're anywhere the global capitalists want you to be. And there's actually a movie, and I haven't seen it yet, but it's called Sleep Dealer. It's like was one of those Sundance films, but it's that exact same exact concept.
I was thinking Ready Player
Three.
Sleep Dealer. And the interesting thing about that is it's actually about borders and immigration and like controlling people at the border, and that they would be stuck like in the Mexican, you know, border and doing remote haptic construction work or like lawn mowing, you know, these different things. And what's coming with the contact tracing and these satellites that you mentioned is geofencing. And the idea of borders and immigration are going to change in ways people cannot imagine, because once they have a digital identity and a biometric monitor, like, they could contain you anywhere. Like, they could make the border your front door. And so I'm trying to figure out how to talk to people in the immigration, because right now, borders are open for global capital, right? Like, the capitalists, the borders are open. They're not open for physical human bodies. And so as this COVID thing rolls out and we start linking health data and these biometric passports and identity systems and geofencing, because right now there are a bunch of cruise ship workers in Jamaica who have been like stranded on these cruise ships, and they're like, well, we'll let you in, but you have to agree to geofencing. So it's already happened. Right. Like that's this week. So the immigration community, I think, really needs to start with global telepresence labor. Think about like globalization is going in a totally new direction that people just are not there yet. And KiwiBots, that's the model. They were sending the burritos in Berkeley, right? Like it was the people in Bolivia that were getting paid $2 an hour to drive the burritos last mile delivery in Berkeley.
I don't know KiwiBots.
So it was a robot program where they would have a human worker collect like fast casual dining. And then they had these little robots, that were like coolers kind of, like they had a little thing you would pop the different food orders in, and then they would have someone remote control drive the robots to the dorm rooms in Berkeley, but the person was in Bolivia and they were paid $2 an hour to do the driving. So it wasn't a smart robot, like it wasn't an AI robot, but it was connected to a person who was not even in this country.
Yeah.
Outsourcing jobs, but in a different way.
My
mind is just
yeah.
But I do have a question. I mean, earlier you mentioned that you're in this weird space, right? You're like in the middle, you know, people that know what's going on and they're implementing these things, and then people that are affected and don't know that it's even happening. It kind of brings me back. You've also mentioned, Obama, undoing protections for data protection.
Yeah.
So in previous shows, we talked about the in the last episode, we talked about this idea of a fundamentalist left. You know, that is it operates in a way that anything that challenges our frame of understanding pushes you out. You know, out of the ego. Like, I wonder if you felt that way. And, you know, what kind of people agree with you? What kind of people resist, you know, your ideas?
So it's interesting. So I describe myself as a recovering liberal. Like, I really am late to this game, right? Like, so I didn't really, it was coming to public education that, like, broadened my view, because the world is built such that, like, we're not meant to encounter people from different backgrounds as peers, right? Like, I mean, in meaningful, realistic ways. And so the organizing that I did with the schools connected me to all sorts of people who had very different life experiences. Like, I grew up in a corporate suburban environment, and I excelled at being really good, like, within that system. And these are people who were coming from very different places that had, like, and, like, wow, like, we're very knowledgeable and, like, navigating those spaces together. And so that experience and being in Philadelphia, which it's interesting because when I first moved here, I'm like, it's so historic and we have all this architecture. I'm like, I loved it for all the wrong things, right? And I'm like, but we also have John Coltrane and we have, you know, MOVE and we have, like, John Africa. We have many other resistance pieces. Like, for every, like, American mythological piece of Philadelphia, like, there's sort of this resistance piece of Philadelphia. So at one point, there's a church in North Philadelphia called Church of the Advocate. And it was Center for Black Panthers did a lot of work there in the 70s and different things. And so it's an interesting space. It's an art space. And there was a Saturday school that would meet and study sort of radical politics. And they did, they would do these conferences. So they did this Baldwin conference. And I went, I'm like, this is really great. And it says, like, anybody can come. And I'm like, really? Like, you know, and then I went. And so, like, my entry point into, like, more radical politics was through, like, looking at, like, Baldwin and Du Bois. It wasn't a white left piece, really. And it was something that was very much grounded in Philadelphia as a city of a black power, specifically. And so, like, I never really, like, the traditional left things that people might come up through, like, wasn't me. Like, and I always, in fact, most of the times I would sort of bump into places and go, like, they're so angry here. Like, they're so intellectual, or they're, I don't know these things. So, like, I never really plugged in. And it was great because that was sort of my grounding, was, like, looking at Black Reconstruction, like, looking at Du Bois. And for me, it was the perfect thing because what I needed to understand was racial capitalism, like, to understand that trajectory. And so, you know, and I love them. I learned a ton. Like, at some point, they couldn't come with me there. Like, and so I, like, moved on. But it was a really important grounding. You know, and right now, this whole situation with the you know, the COVID stuff has thrown everything, because they, for the vast majority of people, they don't understand the paradigm shift that's underway with the fourth industrial revolution. Like, they don't know about social impact bonds, and they don't know about digital identity systems, and they don't know about blockchain. And to try to break through that is really, really difficult. And so really over the past month during lockdown, which has been really interesting, is I connected with Corey Morningstar, who's an investigative journalist and activist in Canada, and who had been covering corporate greening, like the deception within the new Green New Deal elements, and exposing that and taking a ton of heat about it because everyone wants to believe, like, this sort of DSA model. And she was following the money just like I do. Yeah. Like, her program is follow the money. And so she was telling what she saw following the money. Eventually we connected. And so what Corey had was the environmental piece of all the UN Sustainable Development Goals around the financialization of nature. Of the 17 United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, 12 of them are anti-poverty. So I had the people part. So, like, we connected, and within that space of the people who are following her work, all of a sudden in pandemic, the people who are paying attention now are international. Like, far more people are interested in me in other countries, and they're coming at things from, like a holistic health framework, like a spiritual component. And I'm not saying like strictly Christian, like it's a very broad frame of people who can, and they're left. I mean, they're left, but they're not a rigid, they're different kinds. And I don't know how big it is. Like, I was like, oh, my people, like, okay, this makes sense. Like, you understand that the goal is liberation. Like, for me, my base is, do you understand that what's happening is based in the legacy of indigenous genocide and land theft and enslavement, you know, of black people and unfree labor? Like, if you understand that, and you understand that this is like racialized financialization that's tied to this and tied to technology, and you want to fight it on that basis, cool, come on. Like, let's do that. Like, that sort of like, and I mean, I guess I lean like more anarchist at this point, but you know, if the base, like, don't hurt other people, right? Like, I'm not going to tell, like, if you understand that these fundamental pieces and you're not about like, and you're about collective resistance and exposing this, like, let's do the thing. And it's been really interesting to find people on the journey. Like, all the people I thought would be with me, like, they're the people who seem to be waving in techno-fascism. So I'm like, okay, like, that's, I can't make people see it if they can't see it.
Right.
All I can do is lay it out and see if they engage. And honestly, there's a lot of times I just want someone to tell me I'm wrong. Like, mm-hmm. And not just say, oh, you're a conspiracy, you're wearing it. Just like, look at all the stuff I'm looking at and tell me it's not happening. Or tell me there's some loophole that means like we're going to go in another dimension and it won't be relevant. Like, because if I'm right, it really sucks. And yeah. I'm a mom. Like, I don't want to live in a world where my kid either has to be like harming someone by running the freaking dashboards or be on the dashboard. Like, those are our choices. You can be the billionaires or you can be like abusive people running these dashboards. Even if you don't want to, you're going to have to, or you're going to be on the dashboard. That's a terrible way to be.
Right. You're either writing the game or you're playing the game, as you said.
Yeah. Well, or see, so I think in the pay for success world, it's like the nonprofit complex, like they're the dungeon masters, right? So that's why I was like telling my friend Len, I said, it's sort of like you're in a game, the Ivy League MBAs have set up the game, the nonprofits are the dungeon masters, they're doing it to profit the billionaire class, and the rules are enforced by the drones and the police dogs, like robot dogs. Like, that's kind of like where we're going with things.
Right.
And it's going to come in on the digital health passports. Because once they have you on the blockchain, they're not going to just manage you for your vaccines. They're going to manage you for your credentials and your mental status and your housing access. And I was just looking at a document that I had found from 2001 called Embedded Everywhere. It was a national research association. It's like the national overview of the NSF and NEA and all of that. And in 2001, they were already theorizing smart dust, internal, like swallowable medical sensors, and automated buildings. And those were all referenced in the same paragraph. So when you're hearing, like a month or so ago, the head of the Kansas City Federal Reserve saying, oh, we should test everybody every day to make sure you have a badge to show that you're okay. And people are like, how are they ever going to do that? Well, just imagine you have an embedded technology sensor that's like pinging your health status indefinitely. And we're not far off of that. And, like, you're not going to be able to get in your house or your office building if your data isn't lined up.
Right.
And that's like, sounds like a Black Mirror episode, but I think, like, we maybe are a few years away. And I always say it's a matter of they have the technology, can they scale it, and can they make it socially acceptable? And I've been shocked and upset to see how readily people are willing just to go with this
over
the last 2 months.
Yep.
People I never would have thought, like, who I thought understood, like, hegemony, power dynamics, racial issues, like I thought they would understand, and it's like someone has like erased that part of their brain.
Yeah.
I want to say that I'm scared because I just installed a smart TV for the first time in my room.
We had talked about maybe talking about what do we think we should do. We want to try to at least end on a note of like each of us saying, you know, how, because there's a lot of shit you're throwing at us, Allison, and. I think it is worth each of us saying, I think I'm a pessimist and I'm banking on barbarism, but I'm still an activist. So I have to speak to what do I think needs to happen? You know, so I feel like maybe each of us should say something about, like, you know, and then Allison, you can finish up with words of hope, if you will, as best you can manage it. And if they're a downer, we're going to come back and do it again until we get some words of hope out of it. So does that seem like a way to go, Eduardo?
All right. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Then we start concluding from there.
Yeah. I'm not sure how I'll edit this in, but should I start or?
Sure. Sure. Why don't you go ahead? Because you started with barbarism.
Yeah. Well, all I'll say is I share with you, Allison, the amazing degree to which people who I'm currently organizing with, who I'm going to work with, but there is a massive head fixing that's gone around the fear of the virus that has led people to forget. And I believe this intellectually when this first started, but now I feel it in my bones. I am so much more afraid of the state forces and the corporate forces behind that are using this moment and are going to do so much more damage than any single virus, whether you think that virus has a 0.1% virality rate or a 1% or a 3%, although the numbers now all seem, but that the scale of damage that can be done to our society by just the virus alone is paled by the active forces that are using this right now to restructure society. They've been doing this. I mean, public schools have sucked and have always been a problem, but now they're going to take it and kick it up a notch. So I don't want to go back to those old public schools. We're going to have to transform this. I am more convinced more than ever that there's no way to deal with this other than a transformation of society and taking out of the hands of people who have these plans, whether they be the NSA, to the Gates, to the Dells, it's a whole conglomerate. It's a whole network. It's not six people, but it's not 600 people, but maybe it's 600,000, you know, if you figured out all the people who are at the board of it. So they're all working in a sense on the same rough project and they're competing over it. And the thing that scares me is underneath what they're doing, we in the left have understood one thing, that if there's an answer to this solution, it's a collective answer. Whether it's an anarchist one or a socialist one, no answer that we have ever said on our side gets away from a collective response. And that collectivity is being dismantled and destroyed. It's being destroyed at the level of education, of the educational experience. It's being destroyed where workers in South Dakota can be like, so I feel like I want to go on a reminder of the people of, like, we cannot afford to lose that collectivity. If they take that from us, then we are done for, you know? And like, and that's what, that, and I understand how a virus makes it seem like we got to all be spread apart, but if we go to just that fear of the virus and let the powerful forces that want to use that fear against us and break us up, if we let them do that, then we really are done for. And it ain't going to be coming from a virus. It's going to come from the fact that we will not be able to mount a collective response to this. And so that is the thing. I plan on fighting distance learning when I go back to my school. It's not about talking about the fears. I want to stop it. I want to say we should not do it. I think there are some parents who will agree. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot of teachers who are going to say, we have to, we have no choice, or they're going to think that they're keeping themselves healthy. And we're actually hurting ourselves if we do it. But that is my hope, is that I can remind people on my side that we have no hope other than the collective hope. And that is being dismantled right now. And so that's at least something I want to try to do in the coming year, I mean, the coming months, actually. And I'll just say that.
Eduardo?
Oh, you know, just as the corporate class are taking advantage of this pandemic, just as they are trying to take over with their ideas that were, as Naomi Klein, I mentioned earlier, the ideas that were lying, that are lying about, just as they are finally pushing forward their agenda, I think that the working class, the folks that are really being hurt by this, should as well take advantage of this pandemic. They should exploit this moment for what? Well, as prison abolitionists, people should come out of the prison and start, you know, not waiting for parole. People should squat their homes. I think that this is the moment to call for open borders and as well for people to take over the education, because we have a stake in this. And we really do need to, in as far as this topic goes, because we're specifically talking about distance learning, I think that we should, as myself, as a former educator, and now as a very involved uncle in my nephew's life, should organize other families in schools and organize educators and share this information that Alison has brilliantly been presenting. And I'm just wondering how it was obscured in the matrix of the YouTube world, but really, you really have presented so much that I think, even if we don't, or as you said in the end of your presentation that I saw, you may not have all the answers for, just the conversations that we are having now, as we're having on this channel, and we will also be sharing your presentation, the conversations need to be out there for people to wake up. And that's what is important from your work, I think, Alison, which I'm very appreciative of, especially during this pandemic where people are working behind the curtains, trying to do things that people are not as disoriented by because of the COVID-19, right? I mean, it's something that's happening. It's something that's a very sensitive topic to talk about. But it is a way for that, not like it doesn't exist, but it is distracting because people are economically burdened. People are afraid. People are going, people are losing people, like in New York. And it's a serious thing. And during that disarray, these forces are just playing behind. They don't care. So I see myself as you said, Andy, collectively organizing with folks that I know I will be trying to connect with and share this information with at my nephew's elementary school next year, that he'll be, whenever that opens, but even starting the conversation now for the summer. And hopefully my work here in San Francisco locally, where you as well work, Andy, you mostly up high school, but still, I mean, in the same circles,
yeah,
to bring this to light, because I think what we need to start is having these conversations openly and having open dialogue about the pervasive Trojan horse that is coming through, as Alison said, a soft coup within our education field.
Yeah, I just want to say that I hear you when you say that. I want someone to tell me I'm wrong too. You know, sometimes I that's the answer I want to find at the end. Sadly, it doesn't seem that anyone has a convincing argument to the opposite. Might be wrong on the details, but capitalism is not gonna, you know, we can't capitalize the way out of the problems that we're gonna face in the future. To me, the solutions, the road is long. The road, you know, we gotta start somewhere, and it starts with taking control by the way we make a living, you know, and embracing the fact that we are workers, and embracing the fact that we are made to be workers, to sell our labor, you know, and to change, you know, the conditions of that mother, you know, who's learning how to read through her kids' homework, but she's faced between the choice of going to work or staying at home and you know, taking care of her kid. But again, my solution is we first have to fight, for example, in San Francisco, I'm a restaurant worker. A lot of restaurant workers got laid off right away, and they got the city end of the stick, you know, and but now we have to organize around the, you know, severance pay. You get laid off, at the very fucking least, they owe you something. Yeah. But what they did is they told us that we couldn't get our sick pay paid for it. They actually passed some like secret deals in the city, and where my brother got his money taken out. They had paid him $600 for his sick pay, but then they took it away. So again, we start small. We start by fighting with the things that we know we can, you know, we should be fighting in specific. And I think there's something I read in Rigoberta Menchú, an indigenous woman in Guatemala, the Black Panthers. I think there is something transformative about getting in the trenches.
Yeah.
And then you will find your way. But first, you gotta get in there and not be afraid. And that's how I think we need to start. Because we'll figure it out along the way. And even if we don't find the solutions, I'm gonna go down singing. I'm not gonna, you know, like you said earlier, Alison, we fight where we stand.
Yeah.
Allison, and I promise to share this with the Spanish language community and the deaf community that I am involved in, because I think those folks are also probably missing out. You said that someone contacted you to translate in Slovenian. So anyhow, I'll share this along the way.
This in Slovenia. Wow. Well, so the thing, when you were talking about the economics, I mean, I think there was a piece that I read, someone shared with me yesterday, that was talking about like economic independence. And I think that's a huge issue, and it intersects with education, because this education program, and I didn't really speak to it that much, but essentially is the plan is for planned regional economies that are being planned for corporate benefit. And these badges are going to engineer children into certain careers or non-careers, especially as like labor is automated, right? And so, you know, I protected my child from mostly a lot of this, like during their time in school, and they didn't get these badges, right? Like they weren't, like they didn't come up in badge culture. I think, like, I know that the AI systems will be run on badges, right? They will be screening. It's like healthcare codes, but for skills. And what does that mean for them? What does that mean if you create alternative spaces of education that are not based in badges and skills and points, that AI will sort gig workers, which is what the plan is moving forward in the next decade. And that's what the Workforce Innovation Opportunity Act has set up. And in my city for southeastern Pennsylvania, of the 12 high growth jobs, there was like one for $50 an hour, one for 30, and the rest were like 12 and under, right? So how do you live in a major metropolitan area with a $12 an hour job? And that's what they're saying are the high growth jobs. So, you know, if education is meant to engineer cheap people into these tracks, really what we need is not just a different education system, like we need a different economic system, and we need an economic system that stands apart from this. And how do we create some kind of prefigurative space that's based in mutual aid and different ways of exchanging people's skills? Because I think that's one of the other things that has frustrated me with this, a lot of the progressive or left dialogue about open up and like, no, we should just stay inside forever. And I'm like, well, you know, because the economy, like, they want you to go out and do your job, and jobs are terrible. And, like, I will admit, many people have really terrible jobs. Like, it's gotten much worse on purpose. Like, that's how neoliberalism operates. But really, like, ultimately, in an optimal world, like, we should have gifts to share of things that we love with other people, and hopefully, like, create systems that we can meet our needs to live and our families' needs to live. Like, in the best system, we would find work that we like, things to do that we love, and build community and live. Like, isn't that how it should be? So, like, this premise that every work that is, like, we should all, like, have UBI and hang out in hammocks. Like, there are lots of people who would hate that. I mean, like, forever. Like, you might hang out in a hammock for a week and it would be fun, but, like, not forever. Like, we need a system. And so, you know, one of the models, because, you know, I'm trying to figure out what the answers are. An organization that has done interesting work, it's called Eco-Socialist Horizons, and they actually developed a plan. They gathered in Venezuela, and like, and it's based in Maronage, and they brought people from like indigenous communities, different groups like Palestine, like to Venezuela, and they planned out a 500-year plan to like save the world from capitalism. Because like, it took 500 years to get this bad. Like, we're not going to just like fix it in a decade. But like, it had concrete steps. Like, there were several hundred people. And I'm like, okay. Like, if what it is like, for me, the people I've met in this lockdown virtual space, there's this amazing push, I think, around like indigenous ecofeminism, like centered on land, centered in things that are real and like relationships and not virtual reality and not this techno dystopia shadow world that they're trying, Google wants to put us in their box. And like, that's one version, right? But the other version is like something that is more based on land and relationships and people that have like a maternal component and a caring component. And those people are out there. And like, there are many people who have not lost touch with that thing. They may not have the same power as the U.S. military industrial complex and the debt finance matrix, but like there are a lot of people who are tapped into spiritual power, and I've been introduced to like ideas of animism, right? And like, I don't think you go up against like this thing on their terms. If we go up against this thing on their terms, we're not, the end is not, the result is not going to be what we want. So we need to find some other route. And is this like, does it have a spiritual element? Is it a land element? Like, is it physics? Because some of this is also like, you know, I met someone who has built virtual reality, built AI, built gaming, and is totally understanding how dangerous it is. And it's math and waves. And so there's part of me, I don't know if you guys are like familiar with John Trudell. Like, I love John Trudell.
Yeah.
And like energy and clear thinking, and that like a clear thinking human being is the most dangerous thing that there is. Like, especially if in a collective, right? And so I keep thinking, like, we need not to go, like, we need to step outside of their game and find the new game. And I think that for me, I draw a lot of energy in looking at like indigenous land protectors, water protectors in Latin America, like those people, and Wet'suwet'en tribe, like those people who will stand, and perhaps in making that stand can change the physics, the course of how this is. And I can't like put it out on a ledger and say this is how it's going to balance out, but just in my heart, I feel like that's part of it. And I just bought A Wrinkle in Time again. Is it like, and you know, it might be kind of corny, but it is. There's this tesseract, right? And they go after the thing that is the scary thing, is IT, right? It is this dead scary thing, and they win with love. And it may sound totally corny, but I'm like, how do we both get clarity with people? And like, not everyone's gonna come with us at the same time, but like, you know, I have another good friend. It's like, put good energy out. Like, put the energy out that you want to see. Not just like, I want to go and fight this stuff. It's like, no, like, put the good, advance with what you want to see, and you will find the people who feel that way. And so I'm trying. And that's sort of where I'm coming from, because I think if we just did the tally, like, the things would not look good. But I think if it's a 500-year plan, the other person that I love is Robin Wall Kimmerer, and she's she teaches forest biology at one of the New York State schools. She's citizen Potawatomi Nation, but she talks about Chittagan, which is the ember, the fire-carrying tinder fungus. And when the people, the Haudenosaunee, like, were pushed out of their lands and, like, to the Great Lakes, like, they carried the fire in these fungi. And I kind of feel like those of us who can see it, like, we're that, right? Like, we need to keep the spark. Because if we don't do the spark, like, then it's just done, right? Like, just like John Trudell, like, advanced, and like, we build on his stand and his vision, and then we go forward. And I mean, not that I'm putting myself on that plane at all, but like, those of us who can, like, we need to find the sparks and carry it forward and try to like spark other people. And hopefully it's enough, you know? I'm a mom. I have to have hope that, you know, we take a principled stand, and if things fall apart and we just flow into energy of the universe, like, we'll cycle back around in some other good part of the energy if we put the good energy out.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. But thank you for the conversation.
Yeah.
It's a conversation. Like I said, I don't have the answer. And like, I, as a white middle class like person who studied cultural landscapes, am not the person you want planning the end of racial capitalism. Like, I will consult. I'm really good at telling you what the bad guys are thinking. But like, we have to build something different. Like, it's not, it's a revolutionary moment. Like, we can't just like tweak the thing we had.
No. No. I agree. Well, thank you, Allison.
Thank you. So that does it for this week's episode. Thank you, Allison, so much for being here with us. Allison McDowell is a parent of a former Philadelphia public school student, member of the Poor People's Army run by the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, who blogs about the intersection of race and finance and technology at wrenchingthegears.com. And we will link that, Allison, in the episode notes. So what's left is a weekly political podcast that's channel challenging the mainstream left. We post information about our topics and our guests on the episode notes, wherever you found this episode, or on our blog at what-s-left.webno.com. You can find past episodes of this podcast slash channel there and connect with us. I remind folks that if you like anything that you've heard here, please share your favorite episode, rate or review or subscribe to any of our 5 platforms on iTunes Podcasts, the Stitcher, Google Play, BitChute, or YouTube. And if you would like to give us feedback about something you've heard or suggest something for us to cover, contact us through our blog. I'm Eduardo Varga, that does it with our co-host, Andy Lipson and Kenny Cepeda. A big thank you to everyone who makes this show happen. Thank you very much, Alison, for being with us.
All right.
Everyone, stay safe and wash your hands.
All right.
Okay.